This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today, we are beginning our adventure with Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, chapters 1 and 2, The Riddle House and The Scar. In these chapters, first chapter, Harry isn't present.
Okay. Yes. Not a Dursley chapter, thank goodness.
And the second chapter is just Harry's commentary on the first chapter.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, what is it like for you stepping into this monster of a book that is book four? Because it's so huge compared to the previous three.
It's so funny because I was like picking this up off my shelf where I have the others and I was like, oh my God, this is a brick this time, which I'm not objecting to that by any means. It's exciting. I mean, this is the first book where the initial chapter has been very like, it hasn't been a Dursley chapter, which we all know how I feel about that. But this was incredibly different way to start the book. So. I was excited about
that. So what did you think about how it started?
You know, I thought it was interesting to take it kind of a very mature kind of mystery approach to it. Very dark. I know I'm so sick of myself saying that, but I mean, people are straight up murdered in this and for real murdered in this chapter. So, and then we also have a giant snake, which I guess if you object to that, then, you know, apologies. But I really liked the tone and the way it's set up. You know, this chapter sets up the rest of the book, I anticipate. So, and the second chapter is,
So, let's see. It starts with the villagers of Little Hangleton still called it the Riddle House, even though it had been many years since the Riddle family had lived there. So honestly, the first thing I thought of with the Riddle House chapter is the novel I really like, which we talked about, The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Because the Riddle family, to me, again, like they say this whole mystery of murders that happened, it happened 50 years ago, which means this is, you know, this is taking place in the 90s, which means, okay, so it happened in the 40s. And the Riddle, in The Little Stranger, it's the exactly same time frame of like the landed aristocracy and gentry, like just after World War II. And it's really... the decaying, like the last leg of those great family houses until they end up having to be sold and things like that.
That's, you know, I automatically thought about just like perfect setup of any gothic story. I thought about the Shrieking Shack from our previous book, but it just felt very gothic, you know, gothic house setup, which I appreciated. And, I liked how that first chapter introduced the story in such a very gothic way, spooky way.
Yep. And so we've got this. So a murder occurs. Well, a triple homicide happens. Like, no one liked the Riddles. No one was, like, upset that they were died. Because, again, like, social norms had changed, and like, again, like they had lost respect for the aristocracy at this point and just saw them as snobbish and thinking they're better than everyone else. So it's the Mr. Riddle, his wife, and then their son, Tom.
Yeah. Interesting. So when they're killed, nobody really knows how it happens.
Yeah, no one knows how. The coroner's report is such that, you know, they weren't strangled, they weren't shot, stabbed. Like, there is no physical damage to their body in any way, shape, or form. The only indication of them being dead is the fact that they're dead.
They're dead. And they look like, I think they were talking about, they look like they've been frightened to death. And then they can't find the boy, right? They're like, there was, or am I, I'm, maybe yeah. I'm just.
So everyone is very perplexed and aren't sure exactly what happened. So it's the maid who discovers them, runs into the town screaming her head off. And, you know, they end up, you know, there was no forced entry, like nothing looked amiss. Again, apart from the dead bodies, nothing about their bodies, nothing about the house, nothing seems out of place. But somehow the police get it on. They want to take the gardener, Frank, in for questioning.
Always framing the help in these stories.
And do you know who Frank reminded me of?
No, who?
John the Dig in 13th Tale.
Oh, yes. That's so, I'm sorry. I'm just like, I wish you could see my gesture here. Yes, I knew that there was some, like, something that I was forgetting, and that is exactly, yes. Okay, thank you for that, Amy.
Yeah, which, again, John the Dig was not the first. That's a very steadfast archetype in Gothic literature. I think at least one of the first stems from, you know, the caretaker or whoever in The Haunting of Hill House, I think, Shirley Jackson.
Yeah.
I doubt that's the first. I know there's probably earlier variations as well, but yeah, but the one that came across the most is John the Dig in, you know, both their positions as gardeners, caretakers, and in their personalities.
Yeah, very much so. I'm so glad you pointed that out, because that is exactly who that would remind me of. And this, I mean, again, this is just such a different tone for this book to start out with, that it's just kind of, it feels like you're not reading a Harry Potter story. It just feels like you're reading something completely different. You're
like, so, adult.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Frank, again, they sort of arrest Frank by default because there was no forced entry and only he was the only one that had a key to the house.
Right.
And he is steadfast in proclaiming his innocence. And he says the only thing he noticed that was different was that he saw a pale boy with dark hair walking up the street, you know, up to the house.
And everybody thinks he's making this up and full of it. Like, there's no such thing. Nobody else has seen it.
Yep. And so all of the, you know, townspeople are, you know, get together in the local pub and are start gossiping about all of this. And it's like, no, it couldn't be Frank. And it's like, war made him funny, which, again, it made me feel bad for, you know, clearly Frank was dealing with some sort of PTSD left over from World War One. And he also was physically disabled a little bit as well.
That's just, it also makes me think of, there's a movie out, I think it's called Sweetwater. I'm not 100% sure, but it's kind of loosely based on Amanda Knox, who was, you know, wrongly accused of killing her roommate in Italy several years ago.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And she went on like a Twitter kind of rant about, you know, this is my story. Nobody asked me. You are the new movie kind of makes hints at something that I did, but I didn't do. So she's kind of been forever labeled with this, you know, she was accused and, you know, let go.
Like, she was acquitted, but she hasn't been acquitted in the court of public opinion, right?
Exactly. So that's what it made me think of. That it also made me think of this show Rectify, just all this, how much damage that can be done just with that accusation, even if it's cleared. Now, I'm not going to talk about like people that are on death row, wrongly accused on death row. But in this instance, he's said he's innocent. there's nothing to prove that he's did the deed, and yet the town still ostracizes him.
Yeah, and again, what motive could Frank possibly have?
You know, I think sometimes when, quote unquote, the help is accused of things like this, it's money, but then I also don't understand how that works. You know, like...
Yeah, because in so many ways, his livelihood was dependent on the... Like, and again, the people just kept him on when others, like, bought the house because it was convenient for them. Like again, there's no indication to suggest that Frank or any of the other help were embroiled in the Riddle finances in the way that in 13th Tale, John the Dig and them were embroiled in the finances to the point that when the patriarch of that family just up and disappeared, like, they didn't do anything to, like, say, oh, there's a missing person or anything. They just continued to collect the money from the lawyer to manage the house. Yeah. So we're not, Frank, it's not suggested in any way, shape, or form that Frank was in that sort of position at all.
Yeah, and I guess the townspeople are just, it's strange, but I guess they kind of feel like, oh, sorry, I just kicked my fan. Feel like, well, we don't have anybody better, so we'll just go with that. So
yeah, again, old funny dude with PTSD, loner, of course. They're gonna pin it on him. And again, he was the only one with the key.
Right. So it would, it's like, well, of course he could get in the house. I mean, maybe he just kind of, you know, I don't know, had an issue and went, killed a bunch of people in a way that they can't explain. It's not even like, you know, and this is all taking place in the Muggle world, right? Yeah, that's something that I had to remind myself.
Yeah, so the coroner can't even make the suggestion that it was a heart attack or anything, which would kind of make sense since there were looks of terror on their faces. Like, I've read a lot of murder mysteries where, you know, the murderer, like, is pretending to be a ghost or is trying to terrorize someone in a certain way, and their victim, stalking victim, ends up dying from a stroke or something of that nature.
Okay.
But the coroner doesn't even, you know, try to suggest that either.
It's just like mystery death. Like, these people died. We don't know how he did it. So, I mean, I guess that's the thing that I had to remind myself when I was reading this. Like, magic wasn't an option in this situation people reviewing the deaths.
Magic was not an option to the police constables of Little Hangleton.
Yes. Yeah.
And so with no conclusive evidence from the autopsy, they are forced to let Frank go. And Frank continues to live there, but if he wasn't already kind of a loner, just completely ostracized from the town. And what do you think about this? Would you have left or?
Oh, so I enjoy a little true crime paranormal stuff, and that's probably hard to believe. But
shocker.
I know. I was listening to a podcast recently. I think it's called Haunted Road with a woman named Amy Bruni. And she was talking about the Lizzie Borden house and how Lizzie Borden was accused of killing her parents, but she was acquitted and she continued. I think she bought a different house, but then continued to live in the town because she said one day these people are going to realize that, you know, I didn't kill my parents. So she was there kind of defiantly. You know, hindsight, who knows if she wishes she could have left. I mean, she had money because the parents had money. So I guess that was something that made her life easier there. But I don't think I could do the Lizzie Borden. I think I would leave. I think I would be like, which you could say that makes you look guilty. But I just, you know.
Well, anything makes you look guilty at that point. Right. And so, yeah, like a part of me like kind of respects Frank for just being a stubborn ass and, you know, sticking to his guns. But at the same time, yeah, I don't think that I would be in a position to, you know, or at least I would only stay for maybe a few years, not just to not make it seem like I'm immediately trying to skip town or whatever.
Right.
But I wouldn't be able to continue my existence the way Frank has.
No, I need like somebody to talk to, like at some point. I mean, I'm pretty introverted and kind of a loner, but they're, you know, I guess I am married, so I my husband gets to talk to me. Or I get to talk to him. I don't know.
So again, it's kind of wrapped up. It's an unsolved case. And of course, the Riddle House is auctioned off, and it's, you know, it trades hands throughout like the two or, the decades. And Frank just decides to, stay on, and it's convenient for the new owners. And so it gets to a point where someone's bought the house, but they don't live in it, and they certainly are not taking care of it in any way, shape, or form, but they just keep Frank there. And so Frank is just, minding his little old business in his little cottage.
Taking care of his leg, which is worse now. Just kind of having a good old man time here, I guess.
Yep. And then he sees a light flickering in the window.
Oh, man. Who has showed up?
And at first he thinks it's just the kids, getting in there. Because, again, typical in haunted houses, both in real life and in literature, there's always the teenagers trying to, break into the house and do stupid shit.
Right, right. Yeah, of course. I've never been one of those teenagers. I've never tried to break into a house, but I have observed a spooky house from a safe distance. So,
And so he's just like, oh, Christ, these stupid kids. And so he decides to huff it on over to the house. And again, there's no doors that are open, nothing. And it's actually been several years since he's been in the physical inside of the house.
So he's just taking it easy. And then he hears these voices coming from inside.
Yes. And let's see where. And yeah, and he notices that it's not, crazy teenagers. The fire is in the grate in the fireplace.
So it's not like kids blowing stuff up or just being weird. It's I guess kind of if the artwork in the book is kind of a sophisticated little setting, without the mm-hmm. snake behind it, but just a nice couch by a fireplace.
Yes, a very old school drawing room.
Yeah.
And so the first thing he hears is, "There is a little more in the bottle, my lord, if you are still hungry." "Later," said the second voice. This too belonged to a man, but it was strangely high-pitched and cold as a sudden blast of icy wind. And so Frank hears a very interesting conversation. What did you think?
A very interesting conversation. I was going back and forth. It's between Wormtail and Voldemort and Nicky.
So now you know what happened to Wormtail. Were you expecting to see him this quickly?
For some reason, I knew he had obviously he had a connection with Voldemort. Not really. Not like at the jump, at the beginning of the story. But I think it's an interesting choice that they call him Wormtail throughout it. And they don't call him Peter Pettigrew. I was thinking about just reading this when the books came out. And, we're reading them kind of like back to back. I don't know if that was something that Harry was doing to just kind of like mess with you a little bit. Like, remember, this is Peter Pettigrew. Anyway, so in that, I think it's also interesting that Voldemort kind of calls him Wormtail. I don't know if that's exactly flattering. I think it's kind of gross. But
yeah, what it reminds me of? There's this, Memoirs of a Geisha.
Mm-hmm. I've never read it, but I'm...
Yeah, so her like friend that she nicknames Pumpkin. Like, she gives the nickname Pumpkin, but that nickname just ends up sticking. So even though her friend becomes a full geisha and even has her own technical, like, geisha name, Hatsumiyo, like, everyone continues to just call her Pumpkin. So it's just sometimes you, like, a nickname just completely sticks.
That,
regardless of where you are on the good, bad, evil spectrum, that's just the nickname everyone calls you.
No matter the word, that makes sense. I think it's interesting. I noticed, through the conversation, they mentioned the Quidditch World Cup. I know that's going to be a big thing in this. But yeah, interesting conversation. The thing that I kept trying to remember was, and I'm going to forget his name, pardon my memory, Quirrell.
Oh, yeah.
They kept talking about two voices. And I had to keep reminding myself that this was Frank hearing the two voices, I don't know what, I can't like imagine Voldemort right now is what I'm mm-hmm. trying to say. Like, what is his deal? Because And what is this thing that he's drinking? Like, I have a lot of questions that were not answered during this chapter. Yeah. So,
your lordship is still determined then, Wormtail said quietly. Certainly I am determined. So Wormtail tries to propose it could be done without Harry Potter, my lord. What were you thinking about that?
I was a little confused because I'm like, why does he give, you know, like, why does he give a care about Harry Potter? I mean, I don't know if he bonded so deeply with him, you know, in the previous book, because they were trying to set him up to get him to the Dementors, weren't they? Like, they were trying to throw him, the kids were trying to throw him to the wolves, basically.
Yeah, well, again, depending on what, whether you consider death by his friends better or worse or more merciful than sending you, technically letting you live but giving you to the Dementors. So, regardless of what the outcome is, it's the sense that, you know, Peter Pettigrew is only alive because of Harry's sense of mercy.
So he's feeling a little bit of allegiance, and that's probably why. So thank you for helping me, helping clarify that for me. The only other thing that I didn't quite understand is, you know, Wormtail is here saying, like, well, I brought you this lady, like, and he's like, no, it's got to be Harry Potter, you know, like, so first of all, this lady, don't know what, I forgot her name.
Bertha Jorkins.
Oh yeah, there she is. Bertha Jorkins. So I'm sure I'm just being a complete dingbat, but I'm just not fully understanding why he wants Harry Potter so badly. Is he like in the body of Bertha Jorkins? I don't know. And
We don't know what they're planning for Harry Potter. Again, we just know that Wormtail is trying to suggest that maybe they could use someone else for the same purpose. And Lord Voldemort's like, no, it has to be Harry Potter. And not so much Voldemort accuses Wormtail of having any sort of lingering, you know, begrudging loyalty to Harry. What's been commented on a lot in podcast is the interaction between Wormtail and Voldemort. It's like, are you planning to desert me? Like, you are so disgusted by me. It's a very sort of abusive, almost sounds like an abusive romantic relationship.
Yeah, I that exchange between the two of them, I was like, good lord. It was abusive relationship is exactly right. Because Wormtail is so like sniveling at Voldemort's feet, and he's just like eating it up. He's like, yes, sucker, I've got complete control over you. So
by that time, my faithful servant will have rejoined us. I am a faithful servant, said Wormtail, the merest trace of sullenness in his voice. Wormtail, I need someone with brains, someone whose loyalty has never wavered, and you unfortunately fulfill neither requirement. So he traded sides trying to hedge his bets, but Voldemort doesn't appreciate his talents any more than his quote-unquote friend Sirius when they were teenagers.
Right. Yeah. No, I thought that was kind of sad too, because not a lot of people in the wizarding world that I know of yet are really willing to do Voldemort's bidding. And now I wonder who this other person is.
And Voldemort suggests that Wormtail only went through the trouble of finding Voldemort because he, at that point, he had no better options. Because again, he was considered dead to the rest of the world. Sirius Black escaped and was gonna, like, you know, expose, you know, the truth of what really happened. Like, I wonder if there was a like alternate universe. Again, this wasn't the fanfic I thought of, just thinking right now, like, what if Sirius had not escaped and Peter Pettigrew had an option to come out of hiding and maybe just pretend to be a good guy rather than feel like, okay, the best thing I have for survival right now is to be with Voldemort.
I wonder if that Sirius's best bet was to be with Voldemort or Wormtail.
No, that Sirius had stayed in Azkaban.
Oh, okay.
Because at that point, Wormtail was choosing to be in purgatory basically as a rat.
Right.
Like not picking any one side yet.
Right.
And in a way, Sirius's escape forced his hand.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. He definitely seems, and I think I called him this in the last book too, pretty spineless and wishy-washy. And as long as whatever one side was offering was good for Wormtail, that's going to be the side he was going on. And like you said, like hedging his bets. And right now he thinks Voldemort is the ticket, whatever mm-hmm. that ticket might be.
And so, yeah, they talk about Bertha Jorkins and Voldemort's like, Wormtail, why would I kill you? I killed Bertha because I had to. She was fit for nothing after my questioning, quite useless. So, you know who that made me think of? Recent trilogy that I read that you'll also enjoy, Hunger Games. President Snow at the end, I'm not above killing children, but I'm not wasteful.
Yes. That's President Snow was an interesting character. It's now I'm like 10 years removed from that book. It's been a while, but Snow is an interesting character, and to kind of apply that is interesting.
I like yeah, because I think it's true that a lot of villains, I guess recently, a lot of them have been like, if I'm going down, you're going down completely with me and just kill indiscriminately. Voldemort's kind of in the in between. That sort of crazy, like, I will burn the world to be king of the ashes. He's somewhere in the middle between that and someone much more restrained, like President Snow, where like yeah. he definitely in his career will, you know, kill for the pleasure and to make a show of certain things, but isn't as directly bloodthirsty as some other villains that kind of show up in literature and real life.
Yeah.
In crazy corrupt regimes like the Islamic Republic of Iran.
I was thinking with villains in particular that for a long time people were really critical of villains being nuanced, and they're like, we just kind of want somebody to hate.
Well, it was the natural backlash where you again, like, what is Hegel's philosophy that things will swing, you know, on opposite ends of the spectrum until finally coming, you know, to rest in the middle. And yeah, right. like, you know, a lot of people are fed up with the, like, making sympathizing and making a villain relatable to the point that they stop being a villain.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, you could think of, I was just talking about the Joker, and that's what I was thinking of, the most recent Joker. But I think Nagini is an I do know Nagini. I'm aware of Nagini because of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So,
yes. Yeah. Her whole history has, how she got from point A to point B has yet to be divulged, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just know she is an animagi, right? Is that right?
She's not an animagi. She is a maledictus, which is different. Oh, okay. Like, she has a very specific, like, blood curse where, in her time, the Fantastic Beasts, she can transform into an animal, a snake, at will. But her condition is such that it will eventually get to a point that she will not be able to transform back into a human.
Okay.
So she stays forever a snake. And so by the time she's hooked up with Big V, he, you know, she has completely gone into full snake form and cannot be a human anymore.
Okay, cool. Now I know, because the whole time I'm reading this, I'm thinking, like, I remember that gal in the Fantastic Beasts. So I totally took a turn. I just saw the snake. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say criticism, a lot of back and forth about the portrayal of Nagini in the movies is because of her sheer size, a lot of times she's portrayed as a, you know, a boa constrictor in a way. But it's very obvious her fangs are venomous, so she's more like a viper, and so like the way she's shaped doesn't make sense for a viper. But yeah, we don't have to go into the details.
Kind of like Sirius Black
venomous vipers versus like boa constrictors, because boa constrictors, like, they don't poison; they just, you know, squeeze you to death.
Right. That's very interesting. I didn't know that. There's a lot of snake talk here, so we got some parcel tongue talk going on here, I guess. That would be...
How do you think you would react if you were in Frank's position and this big gold snake comes slithering behind you?
I mean, again, I don't... My stress critter world stress is spiders, not snakes. But if that came slithering up to me, I would probably bolt. I don't know if I would be able to deal with that. And also kind of Frank's gets quite the show here in a minute, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, I told you about my giant spider dream. I did have a giant snake dream.
Oh my God.
Where it was a snake that I very much envisioned being that type that Nagini is. And so it was, I was in Morocco. So it was a dream where I was in the room my host family provided for me. And there's this huge snake slithering up to my bed and it raises its head towards my face. And she's like, Amy, it's time for school. You gotta get up. It wasn't evil at all.
It was just like a snake friend alarm clock. I'd take that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so significantly less traumatizing than the giant spider eating my cat.
Yeah, that traumatized me secondhand. That's awful. I don't know if I would be as composed, but as Frank was. And he gets very confused being called a muggle.
Yeah, and so Frank, for all the, you know, incredulity of everything, he's kind of able to put it together that this guy can talk to the snake.
Yeah, pretty quickly. I mean, even it made me think of Harry, you know, at the beginning in book one, where people are just like, people kind of, it seems a little more, not cerebral is not the right word, but I can't think of the right word, adult, for lack of a better word. That Frank is like, oh, this man's talking to snakes. Whereas Harry, it was like, that guy talked to a snake. And it's like, yeah, right, whatever. This is like, oh man, this is some heavy stuff going down. But Frank, I guess also to his credit, has forever mystery of this family being killed. And he has taken the blame for it. And he's not able to explain, you know, why, how these family, obviously, because he didn't do it. But I wonder if there's just a little bit of him being able to kind of suspend his disbelief or something.
True. Yeah, Nagini has interesting news, Wormtail. According to Nagini, there is an old muggle standing right outside this room, listening to every word we say. Invite him inside, Wormtail. Where are your manners?
I mean, what is this guy?
He's such a drama. Big V is just a drama queen.
He really is. He loves the theatrics. I mean, even the, like we talked about, the little sitting by the fire is very, it's almost like he played out the scene in his mind.
It's like, it makes me think of that When I'm Evil song. I forget who sings it, but yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I'll have to send it to you.
Yeah.
And again, there's only a page and a half of dialogue between Frank entering the room and then Frank dying.
Good riddance. Poor Frank. What a tragic life he had. So he was screaming so loudly that he never heard the words the thing in the chair spoke as it raised its wand. There was a flash of green light 200 miles away. The boy called Harry Potter woke with a start.
Yeah. Dun, dun. Although I appreciate Frank being like, you know, my lord, screw you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's.
Because it shows, you know, the whole my lord. It's such a, again, in the 90s where, again, well, I guess it's different because even though it's totally changed, there still is the peerage system and there are still earls and there are still lords and things like that. So, but yeah, it's just the obvious pretentiousness of it.
Yeah, Voldemort, I think, loves his classism, doesn't he?
He does. And yeah, poor Frank ended up dying in the same way as the people he was accused of killing.
Dang, man, that's gotta, what a story that house is gonna have now. Like, that is a haunted house for sure. Interesting.
Yep.
Interesting.
And thus we move on to chapter 2, The Scar, where, again, thinking about this as Harry being the writer, so I envision, you know, Harry, it's like one of those dreams where, like, as you wake up, like, just more details of the dream, you know, fade and fade away till you can barely remember anything.
Yeah, that's kind of, that's how I was thinking of that first chapter as well, that that was the dream. And then he was kind of, it's kind of slowly fading away, but interesting that he's dreaming this reality. So,
yeah. And I imagine him, you know, going back writing this, I imagine him going to Little Hangleton and going through like the newspapers of the original like mystery of when the Riddles died and the maid giving all the details of the maid coming out screaming and what the townsfolk thought, and then going into the other news clippings about when Frank died.
I like that. I like that. And that kind of helps explain, you know, why that chapter is so different than where he's just kind of talking about his life, you know, it's like his writing experiment there.
Yeah, and then so. He's yeah, and then I'm again, he has to dig into some deep memory magic to unlock, like, oh, this is what happened in my dream, in my memory.
We've all had poor Frank. Yes, and I think we've all had a dream that's kind of like sticks with us and we can remember pretty vividly. So this one stuck with him. I can understand why.
Yep. So we get a little bit of recap, but substantially less than before, which I think once you hit book four and again, the fact that this book is a brick, like if you aren't up to speed with Harry Potter, like at this point, then that's on you.
Yeah. Yeah. Like look at the page number here. Look at the page numbers in the previous books. Go read the previous books. But yeah, thankfully, I mean, this chapter wasn't very long. But, you know, I think it, other than the just kind of rehashing of the past, it was mainly him trying to process this dream that he had and, you know, just some reflection on how he got the scar and stuff like that.
Yeah, because his idea is, you know, the last time his scar was hurting substantially was when Voldemort was near him, you know, in the back of Quirrell's head. According to Dumbledore's sources, the last he spoke of it was in End of Chamber of Secrets, was that as far as he knew, Voldemort in whatever form was hanging out, hiding in Albania of all places.
Yeah.
So Harry's like, Voldemort can't be here, like nearby, can he?
Right. And I guess he's relatively close. I mean, 200 miles away is not terribly far, but I have questions about his scar hurting and maybe they get answered later, but I'll ask him when we're done here.
Yeah. So Harry is just kind of like, doesn't really know what to do. And of course we get the little recap of the Dursleys are horrible because like, there's no way I can go to my aunt and uncle and say I had a bad dream and that my scar hurts.
Right, right. They'd be like, yeah, get your magic shit out of our room or something.
Yep, and he's in his head thinking about what would Ron and Hermione say about such a scar. And again, because Harry's situation is so novel because no one has ever survived the killing curse except him. So no one on the planet has a scar like he does.
Right, and... So, yeah, totally. So there really isn't. So he kind of thinks through, and this was something I really like from this chapter, like, who am I going to talk to? I mean, and then he thinks about Dumbledore. And I love that he asks himself, like, what does Dumbledore do during the summer? And then that made me think, I wonder what he does. I disagree with Harry. And even though he's just kind of thinking about it humorously, like, maybe he's on the beach, like,
With a white strip of sunblock on his nose.
That, I mean, I love the humor in that. But then I was like, serious question. I just have a feeling he's probably just still at Hogwarts because, I mean, what's he? I don't know. Or like a Buddha sitting under a tree just gaining wisdom. I don't know. Like, I wonder what he does.
Yeah, maybe he's off doing research abroad. I don't know. Does a headmaster ever go on sabbatical? I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe this question will be answered for me later. I don't know.
Yeah. And then it dawns on Harry, I do have a parental-like figure now who I can talk to.
Thank God, Harry, because I was like, you're freaking godfather, man. Like, come on. But I'm glad he was able to get there finally. So
Mm-hmm. And so he decides that he will write his godfather a letter and restrains himself in just saying that his scar was hurting and does not go into any detail about the dream.
No, it's kind of a weird letter, you know, relative, you know, he doesn't really, a weird thing happened this morning and he's talking about it a little bit, but doesn't give a lot of information. And that seems pretty calculated on his part. For the most part, he just kind of BS's, I don't know, talks about living with the Dursleys, kind of grateful that he can kind of hang Sirius over their head.
Yeah, then, Lord Sirius over them.
Right, yeah. But for the most part, the letter's pretty, it just reminds me of something that when you have like a heavy thing that you want to tell somebody and you kind of put it in a compliment sandwich or something, like when you give something really like, oh, you know, this is, your dress looks really good, your boyfriend's cheating on you with me anyway, and this apple pie is really nice, it's like, what? So that's kind of what it reminded me of, what he was doing in that letter.
Yeah, and I don't know, it's interesting, the notion of dreams in, you know, this series, because Harry's had a few, or let's see, how many dreams has he had that are important at this point? Because in the first book, his big dream was that he actually kind of had a dream that kind of foreshadowed the fact that Quirrell was in league with Voldemort. So I don't know. I feel like even at the young age, even if you take no stock whatsoever in sort of dreams as a form of divination, like dreams always have some sort of symbolism of what's going on with you in any given moment. Like when I'm stressed out, I constantly have the dream where my teeth are rotting or fall out.
I have loved dream interpretation forever. And my version of that has been, I used to do theater and I'll get on stage and not know my lines. Like that's my teeth falling out dream. It's interesting that those repeat.
Yeah. And I had very specific dreams of, like, very recently I had a very horrible dream about a police officer trying to assault me, and the recent symbolism of me feeling completely powerless and being exploited by an organization with authority, that symbolism was not lost on me. So
right, it's interesting. I mean to analyze your dreams, and kind of, I found a dream journal recently and I was reading through it and I was like, what the hell? So it would be interesting to compare the dream journal to the actual journal, and then that would probably help figure it out. But I love dream analysis. So the thing if we could talk about dreams again for one moment, it made me think of Professor Trelawney, and does this give in Harry's mind? I mean, Harry, I don't think was as like irritated by Trelawney as Hermione, but does it give any credence to her? Like, I just wonder how this is going to move throughout the story, him having this dream and divination.
Yeah, because in the wizarding world of Harry Potter, like, divination is kind of perceived as a sort of very, very rare gift that cannot be taught. You either have it or you don't. And so I feel like Harry's opinion is, okay, this maybe does exist in very, very small increments, or maybe a few people can do it, but Trelawney certainly ain't it. Or at least, okay. or she's extremely limited in where she had that prophecy and doesn't remember it.
That also makes me think, like, how many gifts does Harry have? Because he's got, I mean, I guess he's pretty amazing. Voldemort didn't kill him. So.
He's our hero, of course.
Yes. Yeah. But it's just like, it's very interesting to me. So,
I just love the little humor of Sirius was sending Harry letters with tropical birds.
I love that too. I'm glad you pointed that out. And because he really liked them. Hedwig was like totally irritated by them, but Harry was kind of like, oh, this is kind of cool.
Yeah. Like again, how did anyone not notice them?
Right, right, right. Maybe they just thought somebody's pet got loose. I don't know. I see all these parrots on TikTok. So
makes me wonder, like, so other birds have the capacity to have the magical sentience to, you know, deliver letters. And I'm like, dark words, dark rings. Who uses ravens?
Oh, that's just what I was going to say. I'm like, who the hell has a raven? Because that's so badass. Like, I would think, Draco would want to have a raven, right?
He doesn't. He actually has my favorite species of owl as his owl. It's an eagle owl with the big orange eyes.
Oh, jerk. Of course he does, right? That's awesome. Oh,
yep. But is there anything else going on in... Again, he writes his letter. Again, we talked about he's very restrained, doesn't give anything about the dream. I do appreciate, you know, he was going through a few anecdotes of, like, you know, he wasn't upset by the pain. Like, he's dealt with pain. He lost all his bones and had them grown back in one single night. And, like, injury, like, he at least acknowledges in his head injury was inevitable at the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
Right. It goes with territory at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, which, speaking of which, again, Hogwarts as a school, and again, the danger and bodily harm, it also got me thinking, this is a little bit of a tangent, maybe not totally related, but that got me into thinking, you know, some people have criticized Harry Potter, not so much the obvious failed pedagogy, but more specifically glamorizing and romanticizing the boarding school setup, which, you know, is deeply entrenched in certain elements of, you know, British and English, like, educational elite. And there was, in fact, even one actress who was given the opportunity to play Professor Trelawney, I think, and she turned it down because she did not like the boarding school glamorization. Like, people talk about this to the point that there was an actual actor who didn't do Harry Potter because she didn't like that aspect of the series. You know, some people, you know, who spent their whole childhoods in these institutions, that even if they were very prestigious, like, every element of your life, oops, sorry, bumped my camera, microphone, but every element of your life was controlled. And, like, there are, like, certain support groups, like the way there are support groups for gay kids who had to go to conversion camp. Like, it really fucked up with a lot of people, you know, in the head. And again, I'm an American, like, I'm just totally outside that cultural context. But at least in the Harry Potter world, it makes sense because you have all these kids who can do magic. And so and the secrecy is so pivotal and fundamental to their society that it makes sense that you hide them away in the Highlands of Scotland to be able to blow things up without impunity.
Right. And do these wand fights or whatever and all that stuff. That's really interesting. It made me think of recently, of all people, Paris Hilton has talked about going to, like, where I guess they would say Harry's going to, St. Brute's Secure Center for Incurably Criminal Boys. But there was a similar thing in America, and I believe there were a lot of them in Utah, about these teenagers. Those camps?
Yeah. Those reform camps? Oh my god. The scandal behind all of that is insane. And if the kids dared to, like, criticize anything, you know, tell the parents what were going on, that's just manipulation.
Right. Yeah. So that's the, like...
Because none of them were, like, regulated. Like, none of them, like, they were just, like, off doing their own thing. And I'm sure...
It's really gross. I did not watch Paris's documentary, but I saw, like, a Vice News story about those camps. And it was just like, good Lord. So I don't know if that's on the level of, you know, a British boarding school, but I know it's a, serves a different purpose. It's like the St. Brutes, which I guess we're supposed to be led to believe, like, Hogwarts is the romanticized boarding school and St. Brutes is the kind of, you know, reform school, for lack of a better term. I don't know.
Yeah. True. Harry sends off his letter and he's just thinking, you know, hopefully soon I'll hear from Ron, because he talked about the Quidditch Cup later, which we know that at least Voldemort's not going to do anything until after the Quidditch Cup.
Gonna let them have their fun, and then he's gonna, like, get the party started, apparently.
Yeah, so. No, there's a meme on, I've seen several times on, like, my news feed of, you know, despite everything, Voldemort always saved his attack on Harry until the end of the year. Despite everything, at least he cared about Harry's education.
he really wanted him to be like die educated. Like, that's whatever. That's fine. I don't know. That's pretty funny.
And thus concludes the first two chapters of The Goblet of Fire.
I really enjoyed the first one. The second one was okay, but the first one was great. So excited.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to get into Goblet of Fire. Just I feel good that we've gotten through, not totally halfway, but we got through the very large first hump of the first three books. And through a variety of podcasts that I've listened to, various hosts have mentioned that Goblet of Fire is their favorite. So I'm curious to look at it again and think of, why do people love this one so much?
That's interesting. At one point when we first started this, I looked at like how they were ranked and what people really despised and what they didn't. And I'll have to look again because I've been curious about that as well.
Okay, then. I don't know if we even need to bother. We talked about it so much, but the Gothic Geek Out.
I mean, to me, hands down, it's the Riddle House. Like, that's...
The Riddle House, like,
right.
We made so many allusions to Shirley Jackson, 13th Tale, The Little Stranger. I'm trying to think, is there anything else about like the Riddle House, like that specific type of murder? Like, again, I've read so many of these. I'm like, I'm looking at my shelf right now, trying to figure out if there's a book that I'm missing.
Oh, man. I feel like there's something that's like classic Gothic, but I just, it's like on the tip of my tongue. For some reason, I want to say The Castle of Otranto, but I don't know if I'm right there. That might be a little too loose. That's not really a haunted house. It's a castle. So,
well, tomato, tomato.
Yes. I was trying to think of another Gothic element.
Although now you've got me on a tangent where... for the first time, I was able to browse through the stacks at the university library again, because for so long they were doing it where you could only like pick them out online and then and they would be at the desk waiting for you.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, people started going back to the office last week. And so I, you know, went into the shelf and I could actually go peruse through the shelves again. And I was just, it was just dead quiet, just walking through it again. I'm like, oh, I forgot. Like, I could murder someone and no one would find the body for days.
Oh my. I like that that's your first thought when you go back. But you picked up some pretty cool looking books. I was scrolling through social media earlier and I saw, yes. I was like,
getting to that, the books that I picked up was, I'm not going to read the whole book because I'm not interested in necessarily certain histories of like the TV horror and with relationship with Gothic and stuff. But the first two chapters of, it was called Gothic Histories, you know, Taste of Terror, like 1764 to the present. And so the first two chapters were very much about how a lot of this literature, again, it was very much an architectural movement first, where basically all these British guys decided that they wanted to create a Disney medieval version of, you know, a 13th century castle. So like so much of what we know as Gothic literature, yes, there was a Gothic period, but again, so much of the deeply ingrained notions and visual philosophy of Gothic is a pure fantasy. Again, a dark Disneyfication.
Dark, like Haunted Mansion on steroids or something, maybe.
Exactly.
Awesome. Into that. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, just castles, haunted houses. They just all wanted it to evoke that sense of, again, combination of trying to modernize chivalry with like proper etiquette for how to be a gentleman and all sorts of things like that. Again, Horace Walpole, of course, one of the ones going the crazes because he created Strawberry Hill, which was the ultimate neo-Gothic, you know.
Right.
Crib of the time.
The Cribs Gothic. Like, I'd watch that. That'd be pretty interesting. Well, I mean, like, it's hard to, I was trying to think of, while we were talking, any other element that's blatantly Gothic. And I guess, like, if I could, I mean, the Riddle House is, to me, it. But I guess Harry and his dreams. I was trying to think of dreams in Gothic literature that stand out to me. For some reason, I'm thinking of your favorite book that I, Carlos Ruiz.
Shadow of the Wind?
Yes. And maybe it's just because some of his, the way his writing is and some of the scenes are very dreamlike. That's why I thought of that. I don't know.
This is true. Yeah. Are there, yeah, I'm trying to think of how much dreams play a role in that move. Actually, I feel like they play more in the second book because like, or rather actually third, like it's complicated because in the second book you had the story and it was awesome and it was epic. And then you have books 3 and 4, which kind of poke holes on you, and it's left you wondering if that was a reliable narrator or whether he was hallucinating or whether he evil and did kill people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah.
Wow. Well, it's hard not to say the Riddle House. I mean, I feel like that's the,
yeah,
that's the gothic element.
Yeah. And so I actually did something a little different for our next exercise, Tarot of the Day, where I did not pick a card at random, but since the name of a card showed up in the book, in the chapter, the pub is called the Hanged Man.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So the Hanged Man. All right.
Which is card number 12 in the Major Arcana.
Okay. Interesting. The Hanged Man. All right. Now I need to learn about the Hanged Man. I usually think it's a bad thing, right? When the Hanged Man shows up.
Not necessarily. The Hanged Man reminds you that sometimes you have to put everything on hold before you can take the next step, or the universe will do it on your behalf, and it may not always be at the most convenient time. You may have heard the saying, what got you here won't get you there, and that indeed is at play in this card. The Hanged Man calls you to release the old mental models and behavioral patterns that no longer serve you so you can see the world from a new perspective and embrace new opportunities that would have otherwise been hidden from you if you didn't hit the brakes. Here's the thing. These pauses can be voluntary or involuntary. If you're in tune with your intuition, you'll start to have a sense for when it's time to hit the brakes and put things on hold before things get out of hand. But if you're out of alignment and obvious or oblivious to those intuitive signs, the universe will probably put things on hold for you in the form of continued obstacles, ill health, and breakdowns.
Oh, okay.
So what I think of is the fact that basically, Frank's life was totally derailed, and basically, the universe put the pause button on Frank Bryce's life. You know, I guess not so much in his career because, you know, it didn't seem like he had that much business and ambition. He was content to be the gardener, but certainly socially, like I would like to think that if his life had not been derailed by this accusation, that maybe he would have married, or maybe he just would have, you know, found personal enjoyment and gotten other levels of fulfillment and not been a bitter old man.
Bitter old man sneaking up on a snake and a lord of darkness. Like, yeah. Interesting. Well, okay. Then that was definitely a choice to call that pub the Hanged Man. I feel like Harry, well, I guess that was just ominous for that situation.
Yeah, pause again, just the Riddle House itself, that it's, you know, no one is doing anything about it. And like the guy who currently owns it, like all that said is that guy was keeping it for quote unquote tax reasons. Which honestly, my personal headcanon is that there is a wizard, a follower of Voldemort, who has bought that house.
I like that, because otherwise it's kind of like, why are you keeping this creepy old house around? Like, and then I have questions like, was maintenance being done? Other than the gardening, you know, after it kind of was abandoned. And
yeah, I have no idea what sort of, you know, housing regulations were in place in the 90s, or how they were enforced, or all sorts of crap like that.
I mean, I was going to say, fortunately, that is not my fan fiction. I would be like, what if we just talked about the home upkeep? Like, I'm not that boring, but it'd be interesting. I don't know.
So, yeah, All right. Hanged Man is about the notion of taking a second to stop and smell the roses. And it can be in a peaceful way, but it can also be in a tumultuous way, like, you know, card number 16, the lightning struck tower. So, you know, obviously Frank's case. And then pauses, you know, of course, with Harry, his whole like dilemma and commentary on what he's trying to do and figure out. And he's not quick to do any one given course of action. He's not up for dismissing it. Oh, it was just a dream. But at the same time, he's not willing to go into full panic mode over this dream.
Yeah, that was a very like low action, you know, just kind of just walking through Harry's thoughts chapter to get to that. So he was kind of taking a pause. Usually I feel like these chapters are like, you, if you miss a sentence, you miss something that happened. So this this was just kind of him like processing the dream and then going from there, and then the scar hurting, and then what happens next. So
anything else for the Hanged Man?
No, I learned something about the Hanged Man.
The only thing I remember about the Hanged Man, because when I first got my first tarot deck, that was the very first card I pulled.
Really? Interesting. Yes. Interesting. Wow.
Alrighty then. And then we move on to the Rune of the Day, which is, it's kind of like a C, like has two diagonal lines like that.
Okay.
And it's known as Kanaz. Translation, beacon, torch, fire, firebrand. Goblet of fire.
Yeah.
Keywords, light, heat, illumination, breakthrough, creative fire. Let's see. You know, fire was once, you know, the only man-made source of heat in life. Kanaz stands for the fire brand or torch, which people use to heat and illuminate their dwellings and carry from place to place to light their way. This rune represents the light in the darkness, as well as the warmth that fire provides. On a metaphysical level, there is also the light of knowledge and enlightenment. So I know what I thought of.
What did you think of? Because mine's going to be so pedestrian, but go for it.
No, just the, you know, the light in the darkness, that is what leads Frank.
Okay.
Into the riddle house. And the fact, and he's very poignant in honing in on that it isn't the dumb kids just lighting whatever on fire. Like, it's actually in its appropriate place in the grate. Which in a way, that is more ominous to him than just having like a free fire.
That's interesting. I guess I could see that would be more ominous. But that's the kind of thing I was thinking of, is the fire is what draws him to his death, basically. His doom. You know. Yeah.
Yeah. Drawing this rune indicates that you are or will be experiencing a breakthrough in some area of your life that has caused you confusion or anguish. Higher guidance is with you now, bringing enlightenment and clarity. Well, again, Frank really didn't get all that much clarity.
He got his life ended. Like, that's not much, I guess, clarity of the end of life. I don't know if there's clarity after that. But yeah.
Harry doesn't have any clarity.
No, not right now. No, definitely no. He's got mass confusion. But I guess what is this book is also called The Goblet of Fire, so I don't really know what the Goblet of Fire is.
Okay, yeah, there's a funny I think it's the Unspoiled podcast with Natasha and Rashawn, where it wasn't their original reading of Harry Potter, it was the rereading, and when they got to Goblet of Fire, Rashawn said something hilarious about like the movie of, you know, the whole point of, I don't think I'm spoiling anything here, that the goblet itself described in the book when we get to it is very plain.
Okay.
But in the movie, it's very ornate. And she's like, why the hell did they change it? This is like the Nazis going for the super ornate, you know, fake Holy Grail in Indiana Jones.
Oh my goodness. That is, oh my goodness. That's pretty funny. Yeah. In the book, like the little drawing that I looked at, it's pretty, that looks like a goblet. Nothing sexy about it. So
yeah, like to me, a sexy goblet is a chalice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what, I guess maybe they were like, the audience won't understand if we don't have it. Like, it's not called the Chalice of Fire. It's called the Goblet of Fire. Come on, people.
And now we move on to our final exercise, which is fan fiction time.
Man, I didn't do great with this week, but that's okay. I can have a loser.
My fan fiction was, what if Frank had been convicted for the murders despite everything? Despite lack of evidence, because that happens all the time, especially in the 40s and 50s.
You're 100% right. And we also didn't talk about, I don't know if, did we talk about Frank's race? I mean, we really want to get like into it. I don't remember. I think he was kind of pale. So he was assuming he's white. Maybe, and that is presumptuous of me. Interesting, because so then that would have kind of, so nobody would have heard that conversation. I don't know what like Frank's fate is after, you know, I know he died, but I also know somebody else died, Bertha. I called her the wrong thing, right?
Yeah, Bertha Jorgens, yeah.
Bertha, okay, Bertha Jorgens. So I guess we would not have been privy to this conversation, or maybe somebody else would have stumbled upon them, or, you know, I don't know.
Because it doesn't, I guess, and how is it relevant to Harry in the sense that we don't know the exact nature of the dream? I don't think it specifically states whether Harry saw this through Frank's point of view, or he saw this more as a third party.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I think that was Frank's presence pivotal to Harry getting this connection and seeing Wormtail and Voldemort in this way?
That's a good question, because I kind of thought about it as Harry was just kind of like watching a movie, but then there is so much explanation of like Frank, you know, too, and his relationship with the house, so that it can't just be, you know, throwaway. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know.
Again, like with Harry writing this and putting so much stock in Frank's backstory makes, and how it's described, it makes me think that Harry saw things more through Frank's perspective.
I'm thinking also, like, if he didn't show up, the kind of the lore of the house that I speculated is just kind of consistent. And yeah, I don't, it's like my, it's probably because I'm hung up on my fan fiction is why I can't like, because it relates.
Okay, what is yours then?
Mine was, what if Wormtail hadn't like showed up? So, because all I can think through is like this conversation between Voldemort and Wormtail would have never happened if Frank wasn't there to overhear it. I don't know. I'm scrambling my own brain right now, but.
Well, let's see. Putting aside how would have Voldemort gotten in there in the first place, because it's very much kind of implied in their conversation that as abusive and controlling as Voldemort is at this point in a very weakened state.
Okay, that's why Wormtail's kind of bringing these people to him. Specifically, like, he wants Harry, I don't know, for full power is what I'm going to assume without knowing much else.
Yeah, and so I'm thinking that if we accept that somehow Voldemort got there on his own, if Wormtail wasn't there, I could see Voldemort using Frank to achieve whatever, again, clearly caring for him in a way that he needs to be cared for, you know, with the threat of, I will sick my snake on you if you don't do what I say.
That is threat enough, because Nagini is nobody to mess with. Interesting that basically we both thought of this, like, we kept the central character there, but we removed the other two. So, mm-hmm. Because Wormtail, I mean, let's just say where would he have gone? In my imagination, if he didn't show up this quickly, maybe he just ran into the forest and like turned into a rat and hung out there. I don't know. Like, but he obviously is.
And I'm just curious. Not fan fiction specifically, but just general within the canon of the story, is what was Wormtail thinking, or what rumors was he hearing to get to a point that it's like, okay, because quite honestly, if I was Wormtail, I wouldn't even try to go back until Voldemort had shown significantly more of his hand.
That's
and had substantially
point.
More power than he does now.
Yeah, because right now he's just... He's more dependent on Wormtail, really, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, Wormtail wants to make sure he gets in on Voldemort when he's weak so that he can, like, throw it in his face that, you know, I took care of you when no one else was taking care of you and everyone thought you were dead, blah, blah, blah. It's very complicated.
Yeah, it seems very, very complicated.
Alrighty then. And thus concludes Renring Ravenpuff's first episode in Goblet of Fire. Tune in next time for chapters 3 and 4, The Invitation and Back to the Burrow. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mayer Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mayer Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mayer Studios on TikTok, and SophieMayer_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mayer Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMayerStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mayer Studios podcast.